Less than 5 minutes before Ryan and Christy would be interrupted by his panicked cry, Doc knelt carefully at the muddy edge of the murky waters and cupped his hands to drink.
How's it taste?
The armorer was scanning the surface of the water, looking for signs of movement. He took off his glasses for the 100th time since venturing into Green Glades and tried to wipe them clear on his shirt. Even with the scene in front of him blurry, JB could tell that the river's flow could be tracked in centimeters, like slow, sticky molasses. Where the water began and ended was open for debate. Doc smiled and lowered his face into the remainder of the water in his hands, washing his face and eyes.
Cool and wet, my friend. Cool and wet.
Real or fake?
What? This water? Real as it gets.
No, the river. Natural or man-made?
Oh, I am perplexed, John Barrymore. In the scheme of all things great and small, does it really matter?
Guess not. Just wondering.
I question my sanity at moments such as these. In the midst of a steady, warm rain, I am trying to ease my discomfort with the touch of more water. Such is the logic of Deathlands.
JB removed his canteen from his belt and extended the small metal canister to Doc, who ignored it. He was busy shifting his body, leaning back on his haunches and getting out of his kneeling position.
While you're down there playing in the water, fill this up, would you?
In a moment, John Barrymore.
Doc reached down to pull off one of his high black boots.
I have personal duties to attend to first. If you cannot wait, please avail yourself personally of the facilities. I'm afraid we have no running hot water, but at least it is safe.
JB watched as Doc removed one boot and one grayish-white sock. A long, bony foot, whiter than the pallor of jackskin, appeared as Doc peeled away the unwashed hosiery. Once he realized what Doc was preparing to do, JB's inclination to tend to his own canteen was spurred into frantic action. He bolted forward and knelt on one knee, dunking his open canteen into the river and filling the portable container.
No. Help me with my second boot, friend Dix. I fear it has become a permanent part of my left leg.
His canteen refilled, JB stood and clamped it back securely to his belt. Next to him, Doc impatiently waggled his still-booted foot.
You pull one way and I shall pull the other, and together we shall free my appendage of its leathery imprisonment, allowing me to wave all 10 toes in a gesture of gratitude.
Need my hands free to draw in case some mutie bastard crawls out of the water.
Doc used his bare foot as a brace on the booted heel and pushed. At the same time, he utilized both his hands to shove down on the upper part of his boot. The result of his efforts took both Doc and JB by surprise. The footwear exploded off his leg and went sailing away. Doc got to his feet, one leg bare up to his calf, the other covered with a white sock, and marched out into the water, with as much dignity as he could muster, to retrieve his boot.
Hold up, Doc. We don't know how deep that river is. You might need some help finding your flying footwear.
Thank you for your words of caution, John Barrymore, but I think I can find my way to where my boot landed without your holding my hands.
Suit yourself. But if a croc takes a bite out of your scrawny ass, don't come crying to me.
Still, JB kept a careful watch. Doc waded out easily enough, and the water never went beyond his waist as he reached his half-submerged boot. He grabbed the boot and held it high like a trophy as he began to return to the riverbank, never dreaming that his movements had indeed triggered the attention of a silent parasite, but a parasite unlike any he'd ever been exposed to before. The leech was on Doc before the old man ever knew what had happened. Stirred up from slumber by his walking along the river's sediment-covered floor, the creature was nearly 8 feet in length. The wormy mutation was vibrantly colored in shades of red and turquoise against black. Already, one posterior sucker had softly attached itself from below to Doc's unprotected foot, and now, using the anchor his flesh provided, the other end of the leech elongated up out of the river from behind. The pseudopod stretched around and above Doc's shoulder, a tentacle intent on finding another haven of flesh to attach to. Unfortunately for Doc, the widest possible area was his unprotected face. Christy and Ryan ran to the edge of the river.
Bloodsuckers. Fireblast, but that's the biggest one I've ever seen.
Christ, Ryan, what kind of leech is that?
Mutie. Contained a man dry in minutes.
Dean raised his Browning to fire, but Christy slapped it down.
No, Dean. The bullets will tear right through that horror. You might hit Doc.
JB had cast aside his Uzi and the Smith & Wesson M4000 scattergun and was preparing to dive into the water.
John, don't go in. There's bound to be more of them.
JB hesitated, but only for the span of a second. Only until Ryan kept moving past him and went under. So JB jumped in after him. In the dirty haze of the river, Ryan was soon able to spot Doc's legs and pushed his body closer while trying to keep alert to the presence of any more of the huge mutated leeches. Behind Ryan, JB kicked up dirt and soap from the river bottom and was rewarded with a bloodsucker of his own. The freakish creature came up, undulating around and behind the armorer, slithering its interior end up under his leather jacket. JB hurriedly pulled off the jacket as well as he could, first freeing one arm and then the other. He began to twist the sleeves tighter and tighter, finally managing to crush part of the bloodsucker inside the coat. When Ryan reached Doc, the old man had fallen over in the water, his legs kicking up as he struggled to breathe. The Ponga bit deep into the pulpy surface of the leech, releasing a pulsing stream of red blood. Ryan pulled Doc upright, trying to get him to stand on his own 2 feet, while JB staggered over and wrapped an arm around Doc's waist. The old man's body continued to thrash and contort as he struggled for survival. Ryan gripped the edges of the dying bloodsucker's anterior end that still clung to Doc's face. He hesitated, not knowing just how tightly the leech had attached itself. The creature had dozens upon dozens of tiny needle-sharp teeth, and all of them were buried in Doc's flesh. Ripping the leech away might save Doc's life, but disfigure him permanently.
Do it! Better alive and ugly than dead and pretty.
Unfortunately, the leech proved to be annoyingly true to its name. Even after the beast's death throes, the mouse-like creature refused to let go.
No good. I'm gonna pull his eyes right out of his head like this. I'll have to cut it off.
Ryan peered intently at the join where the bloodsucker skin met Doc's and gave himself a quarter-inch margin for error. More of the creature's blood poured out, coating Ryan's hands and upper arms. The coppery smell of fresh blood hung in the air like a sodden blanket. Ryan knew the new color was Doc's blood, sucked out by the parasitic beast. He had cut away half of the leech's head when it finally let go, the evil teeth releasing their hold.
Thank you. There is no safe haven.
Not true. Safe haven was at the riverbank. You're the one who left it to go splashing around the water. And look what it got you.
Mildred was cleaning the deep wound on the upper part of his left foot.
This will take a little longer to heal than your average abrasion. And this rain isn't going to help. Blood-sucking leeches produce a chemical called hirudin. It prevents the blood from thickening and makes it easier for the leech to...
I get the picture, Dr. Wyeth. Your words and terminology paint a most disturbing portrait.
How soon before he can walk?
Now, if he wants to. He may look like hell, but there's no real damage to keep him off his feet. I wouldn't recommend a long march until he's had some sleep and a chance to build back his blood supply, but he's good for a while. I had some antiseptic to clean out where the leech attached to his foot and face. Luckily, the teeth on his face didn't go deep. Those marks should fade soon without any scarring.
Mildred pulled a dry sock onto Doc's injured foot and over the bandages. The extra pair had been squirreled away by Dean in a pocket. Although too small for Doc's long feet, the donated hosiery had the advantage of not being sodden. JB assisted Mildred with pulling on Doc's long boots. Using their shoulders as a brace, the older man pulled himself to his feet. Christy handed Doc the silver lion's head sword stick, and he began to hobble around.
Funny seeing Doc use a stick for walking instead of sticking.
Good as new?
Not hardly, but I am not ready for the scrap heap of the broken down bodies and minds of the elder folks' home as yet, madam. The good Dr. Wyeth has managed to patch my hide yet again, and for that, I am grateful.
JB was peering around the grassy jungle. He turned and waved Ryan over to where he was standing.
See something?
Through this murk? Not much. Glad we're not under attack by some marauders right now. Chopping up beauty leeches under my nose is one thing, but I'd hate to have to try to aim my blaster at something smaller than a barnyard door.
So what did you want? You're facing in the wrong direction. I don't feel like backtracking.
Glance over there to the right, back a little from where we came. I can't be sure without my glasses, but I believe there's a break in a wire sect fence over there. That's a fake backdrop on top. Must have been to fool folks out here. If we can squeeze through, should bring us right out in the park.
You're right, JB. I'll tell the others.
One quick explanation later, and the party collected at the torn fencing.
Once there was a trail here. Shortcut.
Jack stood and half-heartedly brushed the mud off with his knees.
Not used in a long time.
I'll go through.
On the other side, Ryan extracted himself from the fencing as carefully as possible, enjoying the feel of hard asphalt under his feet. He saw some machinery and a lone open control panel, deep dark grease and oil stains that time and the rain still hadn't managed to clear away, faded white and yellow lines on the ground. Ryan decided that he was behind one of the mechanical attractions of Boss Larry Zapp's amusement park. He made his way around to the front, seeing a fallen mass of painted metal. Some cables were still attached, spider-like, to a scaffolding above. The ride looked small, like a thrill cart adventure that spun in a tight circle for the thrill junkie.
All right. I can't whistle, so you better just come over.
I'd say the Baron's place is closed for the season.
I remember you. I remember you all.
Ryan spun in the direction of where the words had come from, dropping to one knee and pulling his Sig Sauer out with practiced ease. Other members of the group followed suit. The sudden appearance of firepower was more than overkill for the sad sight they discovered they were confronting. A lean man, dressed in a yellow short-sleeved sport shirt and threadbare plaid shorts, was standing next to the entranceway of the ride formerly known as the Whirling Upchuck. He wore a pair of well-used tan leather sandals, and the top of his bald head was beaded with raindrops as he looked at the plethora of weapons aimed at his face, neck, and groin. He raised a liver-spotted hand in a universal sign of greeting.
You can put away the cannons, young fella. I'm not packing any heat today. Left it inside where I was watching you. Too wet out.
That's a good way to get chilled fast, old man.
So what? I'm 1 foot in the flippin' graveyard anyway. You'd be doing me a favor. What happened out in the swamps?
We made some new friends, but they weren't too friendly.
What? The man-eating frogs? Killer snakes? Muty cranes? I've seen them all.
You make that all sound almost funny.
Well, it is. Unless you're the one with your balls caught in their teeth.
No, all we had to contend with was a couple of giant leeches. Almost socked Doc, but good and dry.
God damn, that's a new one on me. Giant leeches. Hell's bells.
So, you think you know us?
The old man nodded.
Well, I don't remember you. You must be losing it. It happens with age.
Nope. I may look like a decrepit old rip to you people, and I'll be the first to admit I'm nowhere near as fast as I used to be. But my eyes are still sharp, and the mind's clear. I used to work in the now nearly extinct art of creating illegal identification cards and access passes, and I was always good with faces. Let's see now. A black woman beside a white man with spectacles, a tall drink of water with long white hair, a beautiful woman with flame-red hair, and a boy on the shirt tail of a grim man wearing an eye patch. Don't recognize the pink eye. He's new, and the boy's grown a bit. But still, yeah. You were the outlanders who passed through here when that son-of-a-bitch fairy was trying to take the place out from under Boss Larry.
Ryan's keen warrior senses, developed over the long years of survival in Deathlands, had gone into triple red from the time the men appeared. There were plenty of spots for a sniper's nest in this part of the park, along with ample cover if one wanted to plan an ambush. The wrinkled man in the ugly summer clothes could be a diversion. Still, none of the danger signs had come creeping across Ryan's skin.
Christy?
Ryan knew that Christy would already be using her seeing abilities to check for any kind of hidden presence or threat.
Not feeling a thing, lover. I'd say the old coot is exactly what he appears to be.
No need to be insulting, young lady. The name's William B. Chapman. You can call me Wild Bill, if you can say it with a straight face.
Actually, to say the man was an old coot was about as accurate as referring to the nuke war that had brought about Skydark as a friendly pillow fight. William B. Chapman looked like a walking framework of bones and sinew, topped off with a sunburned raisin for a head. He made even the skeletal Doc Tanner look as young and rosy as Dean.
I'm Ryan Carter. This is my boy, Dean.
Ryan then introduced the rest of the travelers in turn.
I'm glad to meet you, Mr. Carter. All of you. You don't get too many visitors these days.
You're one of the Wrinkleys from outside the park.
Dean referred to the condo development located between Green Gladesville and the swamps. In his more coherent days, before the dream rotted his intellect, Larry Zapp had set up the place as a walled safe haven for the old and infirm, as long as they had enough jack to afford his protection. Never one to pass up the means to make a profit, Larry had taken a former minimum security prison, equipped with separate bungalows, and modified it for his own use. After first learning of the setup, Mildred hadn't been able to resist commenting that Larry had managed to make retiring to Florida take on a whole new meaning. Getting old in Deathlands had to really be a bitch, Ryan reflected. He'd never really thought about getting older. Watching Doc deal with the weariness of body and soul on a daily basis was enough to push the image of a 70-year-old Ryan Cotter hobbling around on the rad-strewn byways far from his mind. In his younger days of riding at the trader's side on Warwag 1, Ryan had always assumed that he'd never live long enough to worry about advancing age. Now he had a son to care for and a group of friends who depended on him. He also had, for all intents and purposes, a wife.
I am indeed a former resident of Zapp's Rainbow's End Retirement Complex.
Former?
Boss Larry's passing meant an end to our security, young fella.
Bill's choice of term for Doc caused everyone to grin. Doc hadn't been addressed as young in a long, long time.
Although, truth be known, even with all of Larry's alarms and motion detectors and armed security men, we were still trapped on the inside like chickens in the henhouse when the fox came calling.
Ryan knew firsthand how the security of the retirement complex was a blessing and a curse. The elderly compound inhabitants had been one of the lures for Adam Traven, who in addition to his pimping and drug selling, also had a sick blood fetish. Soon after his arrival in Green Glades, Craven had started leading his youthful followers over the wall in the retirement area on a regular basis for long, bloody nights of dark snaking, a term Craven had invented for the murder sprees he'd conducted. Those who owned the tidy homes inside the complex had paid a bundle in order to sleep at night with the impression that nothing could get in to harm them. They were wrong. Once past the sentries into the backyards, it took little effort to break a window, slip a latch, then enter and creep around the interior of the chosen home as the elderly inhabitants slept, blissfully unaware of the horrors that had invaded their lives. Unaware until Traven woke them up and the gutting began. An unarmed Ryan had been forced to accompany Traven and seven of his followers on one of the killing sprees. By the time Ryan had gained the advantage, only two of the killers had escaped his own murderous wrath, and it was the last time Traven would ever harm an innocent.
I remember seeing your group when the late Mrs. Owen accosted the park's head sec man about wanting Boss Larry to add more protection. Well, guess Larry had his own problems at the time, huh?
Yeah, you might say that.
Well, I came out here to offer you folks some supper and a dry roof. This joint ain't what it once was, but I've managed to keep my own patch of heaven functioning. Come on, you can check out Central Avenue. It's the main spoke toward the Centerpoint Tower and restaurant, and the best and quickest way to cut through the park.
A statue of Gussie Goose held up a broken wing in a sad greeting as they went through the twisted iron gates that led to the incredible Green Glades replica of a turn-of-the-century small-town American street. Central Avenue was a collection of shops and eating establishments, with a city hall, a fire station, an old-time cinema, and even a post office, all located shoulder to shoulder. An appropriately seedy penny arcade promised thrills and excitement for a mere cent. A ladies' boutique advertised the latest in spring hats from Paris. Near the end of the street, a large granite railroad station was tucked away in a far corner. A twin extension of elevated spaghetti-like tracks for silver monorail cars to glide to and fro, carrying passengers to other parts of Green Glades, stretched out from the second floor. The monorail tracks had fallen in several places near the exits of the station, eliminating the possibility of any future journeys. More evidence of transportation could be seen on the avenue proper as well. Horse-drawn trolleys, minus the steeds to pull them along, double-decker touring buses with stripped engines and flattened tires, pitted, yet somehow still red, fire engines, and ancient replicas of horseless carriages once gave visitors the option of riding instead of walking. But now, all of the vehicles were frozen and silent. Some of the little buildings along Central Avenue were in better repair than others. Boss Larry hadn't allowed Ryan and the others to tour this section of the park during their earlier stay, probably because of its ill repair. The Fat Baron's ego wouldn't and couldn't have allowed guests to view any part of his domain that was less than perfect. The memories and thoughts the quaint street triggered in each member of Ryan's party were different. For Doc and Mildred, a vision of what America once was during their individual lifetimes came rushing back. More so for Doc, who had literally lived in such a turn-of-the-century setting with his family. But even the younger Mildred had seen this type of homey ambience on a daily basis during her small-town southern childhood. For For JB and Dean, such period architecture had only been glimpsed in books and vids. Yet at the same time, there was a sense of place and community here, even in the exaggerated form that the theme park provided. And for Ryan and Christy, the cracked sidewalks and overgrown flower beds, the broken shop windows and elegantly sculpted rooftops, the non-functioning fountain at the center of the hub at the end of the street, all of it was a whispered kiss of what a man's and a woman's life could be and once was, before the darkness fell across the world. Only Jack seemed unmoved.
What happened after we left?
All hell broke loose, Missy. That's what happened. Most of us still in the retirement complex didn't know much about blasters or fighting. That's what we were paying Boss Larry's boys for. A few of us had blasters, at least had the presence of mind to take up the guard stations, but after a week or two, we decided we were guarding ourselves against nothing but a case of boredom. The murders in the complex had stopped. We found out later Traven was sneaking in with his band of crazies and killing off families for kicks.
The group strolled past the mock streets of Central Avenue and entered a new section, easily identified by the new color of the curbs, trash cans, and other markers.
Here we go. Magic Land, the most popular part of Green Glades theme park.
This section of the amusement park was a shock to everybody. Even though some of the rides had started to exhibit signs of age or lack of adequate repair during Larry's reign, now the once carefully cultivated grounds were overgrown and tangled with vines. The paved walkways were chipped and cracked from the earthquakes, and many of the larger, colorful rides had fallen over in a massive heap of metal, creating a rusted shambles.
What happened to this place?
Cajuns is what happened. Crazy sons of bitches. Once word got around about Boss Larry going down to the count, Green Glades became open season.
Cajuns a long way from home.
Yeah, I guess they were at that. Even back in the days of Boss Larry, bands of them had crossed over from Louisiana into the upper panhandle. Time passed, it just got worse. The Cajuns were always causing Boss Larry to have fits, but none of his sect men were willing to wade out and try and take them on in their own environments, no matter how much jack Boss Larry put up. Yeah, I heard it was nuke trouble. Some kind of rad leak cooked the bastards right out of their swampy hellhole.
You heard right. We've been there. Nothing left of that part of Louisiana but a sun-baked desert.
Ace on the line there, JB. It makes sense now. I couldn't figure out for the life of me why Cajuns had come all this way. Now we know.
We think they saw the rad poisoning coming, so they decided to find another home with the same climate. Probably got some boats to make the trip along the Gulf. I heard they set themselves up along the coastline of Mississippi and Alabama, along about where Biloxi and Mobile used to be. There's all kinds of tales about a Cajun boss by the name of Rollins. Guy takes being a midget a little too close to heart and fancies himself to be the next Napoleon.
I know about him, Dad. Learned his game back at the school. He was a shrimpy man with a thirst for conquering way back. Saw himself as the biggest baron in the whole world. Took over every vill he could find.
Ah, but did you also learn that Napoleon had his Waterloo and his Elba? The ultimate fate of any and all who become crazed with power.
Well, he had a triple good time while it lasted, Doc.
Napoleon, Boss Larry, and now Rollins. Sounds to me like another tin-plated swaggering asshole with delusions of grandeur.
Aren't they all?
Ironically enough, after passing the varied amusements, then hanging a left at Centerpoint, Bill took the group to the Gator Motel, the very same place they had stayed during their last visit. The building had once been cruciform in shape, with a central lobby at the midpoint of the four arms. A fire from long ago had destroyed three of the arms of the cross, therefore effectively leveling three-fourths of the motel. The surviving section was known as the Gator Wing. The motif was pure jungle, with once bright hues of shocking purple and pink and blue. The carpet had been nearly trod through, but enough remained in places to hint at the sea-green color the floors of the hotel had once been. Still, despite the rundown appearance, the place was dry.
Ooh, I would love to grab a shower. I haven't felt so sticky in I don't know when.
You're in luck, my good woman. Place still has running water, but don't overdo it with the hot. The heater's been moaning and groaning something fierce. The emergency generator's still up and sparking, so there's electricity for lights as long as we don't overdo it.
A bath? Man, that'll be a hot pipe. Maybe they've still got some of that Prince Mayakovsky splash-on smelly stuff.
Remembering the rancid odor of the long-gone bad aftershave, Christy wrinkled her nose.
Gaia, but I hope not.
How many rooms do you need?
4 if you can spare them.
That would provide a double for JB and Mildred, Jack and Dean, and him and Christy. A single would suffice for the companionless Doc, who deserved a reprieve from putting up with the younger and more rambunctious Dean and Jack.
But I guess 3 will do in a pinch.
4 shouldn't be a problem. Plenty of space in the Gator Wing here at the finally appointed Gator Motel. I'm here all alone.
The hot water of the shower felt good on Ryan's skin. After waking up soaked in the Gateway Chamber that morning, and then being sodden for hours during the rainy trek into Green Glades, with the added bonus of the dunking, courtesy of those giant leeches, he debated subjecting himself to yet more water by bathing, but was now glad that Christy had insisted. First he shaved with good hot water in the salmon pink sink, shaving cream courtesy of the medicine chest in the room's bath. Then he discovered actual toothpaste in the same chest, as well as a pristine cake of soap, still shrink-wrapped in the original wrapper. A worn but clean Gator Motel washcloth from the storage closet outside the room would help top off the experience.
Room for one more?
It depends.
On what?
On who that is behind the curtain. I don't want any old dried-up wrinkly in here with me.
Sometimes you have to take a chance. Go with your gut instinct.
It's not my gut advising me right now.
Good.
Long days had passed since Ryan and the others left the walls and attractions of Green Gladesville. Wild Bill had pointed them in the direction of what he said were the broken remains of Highway 10 from the edge of the theme park's parking lot. Surprisingly enough, numerous stripped, burned, and corroded cars still dotted the asphalt lot, each one parked in its lonely slot, waiting vainly for its owner to return.
Green Glades was located right off the highway for easy access. At least, that's what the old park brochures say. A lot of the structure was damaged in the last quake, but it's still passable. Go up this ramp here.
Bill pointed to a broken but climbable concrete and steel overpass that could be seen towering above the tree line edging the park area.
And then turn left. Stay on the old road, and it'll carry you clean across the state to Jacksonville. It's pretty much a straight line to the East Coast. There should be some small vills set up along the way. Nothing much, but enough to trade with and get the latest info on any marauders or other road hazards you might be walking toward.
You're welcome to come with us, Bill. Nothing left for you here. And when those Cajuns back in the swamp don't report in, I imagine there'll be others out looking for who chilled them.
Thanks, but no. I'm staying put. I'm too old to change my ways now, and I know where everything is. Don't want to have to go and relearn. Those Cajun bastards won't bother me. Besides, my wife's buried here, and I just as soon stay close to her until my time comes. Don't know if a man like you can understand that, Mr. Carter, but that's how I feel.
A younger Ryan Carter wouldn't have understood Bill's logic of wanting to remain behind, tending to his dead wife's memory. A more experienced and wiser Ryan Carter knew exactly what their new comrade meant.
I never question a man's feelings. You watch your rear flank.
And you yours.
The old man stood in the rain and watched the group depart. He stood there for a very long time before he turned and went home. As a benefactor, Bill had been second to none. He had insisted on sending them out with a small smattering of foodstuffs from his own kitchen and some fresh underclothes taken from one of the plastic-wrapped supply rooms that once fed the numerous Green Glades theme park souvenir stands.
You'd look great in mouse ears, Doc.
Wrong theme park, madam. No mouse ears or ears of any sort other than my own shall adorn my noble brow, and I am not about to wear a hat decorated with the bill of that cursed goose mascot that adorns so much of the decoration here. However, you would do well to wear such attire.
Why's that, Doc?
All the better to tell the world firsthand she's a quack.
However, despite Doc's reluctance to serve as a corporate shill, Dean and Jack had both eagerly accepted standard-issue baseball caps with the official Green Glades logo embroidered on the front. The rest had decided to stay with their own familiar fedoras and hats for protection. Considering that the rain had only let up for intermittent periods during their journey, the hats had been a wise choice. Day upon day and night upon night had been dank, dark, and wet. Roughly at the midpoint of their journey across the state, The small procession, slouching through the pummeling rain for yet most of another long day's walk, discovered a sign. The sign, in red letters on white, read, "Good Fod Fast."
I fear proper spelling is following close on the heels of the eradication of the King's English in modern society.
Doc tapped the misspelled word with the end of his sword stick as the group stood in a half circle and looked at the badly painted enticement.
Doesn't matter, long as the food's good.
You mean fod's good, John. You're right, though. Illiteracy never stopped a good cook unless he mixed up the sugar and the salt.
They must have painted over an old highway road sign.
Ryan used the edge of his tonga to scratch away at the outer coating, beneath the badly applied cream-colored layer.
I'll bet this was the exit sign for drivers. Not much use for it now.
We talk or we eat.
Might as well.
Ryan took the point and led the group down the exit to the restaurant below.
Get us out of this rad-blasted rain for a while, anyway.
Who's Tucky, Dad?
Dean looked at a ruined but still legible mass of plastic that rose imposingly on twin steel legs above the sloped roof of the restaurant. One corner of the towering edifice was missing, but the name of the eatery was still readable.
Think he owns this place?
No. That sign's before time. Tucky went down along with everybody else after the new cost.
Mildred was about to attempt an explanation, then thought better of it. At times it was better to keep silent and let some of the less memorable customs and institutions from her past remain buried in the refuse and rubble of time.
Tucky's. Sounds like Sticky's.
Now there's a meal I'd want to eat. Give me a heapin' help and a sticky meat.
Ugh, gross.
As they approached the building proper, another sign near the thick glass and wood door proclaimed, "Visit our Pettin' Zoo." Beneath the pronouncement, in small letters, was added, "Real live mutants."
Wonder what's in the zoo, Dad. You think they really got muties?
Probably. But a mutie is nothing I'd want to pet, son. And I'd sure as hell not want to put up any jack for the experience. Best leave the poor bastards alone.
Ryan held open the glass door into the restaurant and allowed the others to enter.
Well, I guess it's nice to know some things never change.
The group took in the room's furnishings and decoration. Tucky's was almost a perfectly preserved relic from the pre-dark days of 1974. The interior of the eatery held everyone's eye. The dominant color was a faded reddish-orange. The tables, the chairs, even the walls were covered in the vibrantly toned yet well-worn formica. Overhead, non-working electric lights came with plastic orange shades. The scuffed floor tiles underfoot were a mix of off-white and a light yellowish-orange, arranged in a checkerboard pattern. Each of the tiles came with a small letter T embossed in gold in the center.
This Tucky guy must have loved orange.
Ryan, once he'd had his fill of the orange, took in the rest of the dining room. One older man sat at the bar, sipping at a mug of what looked like coffee sub. A small saucer in front of him held a few blackened pieces of bread. Across from the man, in a booth, sat another traveler who appeared to be in his mid-30s. He was eating from a bowl with a spoon and stared back at Ryan as the one-eyed man gave him the once-over. Deciding the eatery was apparently what it appeared to be, Ryan strode across the floor to a windowless wall and chose a large round table located in a corner of the dining room. Two thick orange candles were in brown bottles at the middle of the table, serving the dual function as a centerpiece and as light to eat by. He took the seat nearest the wall and leaned back. From this vantage point, he could see anyone who came in or out of the entrance and had a good view of the dual kitchen doors to the back. JB sat on his left and Dean on his right. Christy took the chair next to Dean. Jack, Doc, and Mildred completed the circle. A waitress came from the kitchen. Attired in a dirty uniform and two shades of orange, she looked to be in her late 40s. Her dark brown hair was tied back in a severe bun and tucked under an orange paper hat. A name tag above her left breast read, "Hi, my name is Sandy." The Sandy had been added in black marker. She carried a well-chewed yellow number 2 pencil that was almost a nub in her right hand and a small notepad in the left.
Afternoon. You folks passing through, are you?
Right about that.
I knew. I know all the locals.
Saw your sign out on the interstate and thought we'd come in and eat before it got dark.
My husband and me? We painted that advertisement up there all by ourselves. Nowhere else to eat for another 40 miles, and not a better place until you hit the East Coast.
Pray tell, Madam Sandy, what is on the famed Tucky's menu for a hungry traveler?
Same as what was on it last night. Stew.
What kind of stew?
Stew. Well, stew, I guess. Hell, I don't cook it, I just serve it. There's some meat. Not much, but enough. Some vegetables, pepper, you know, stew.
Looks like we're having stew, then. You serving up real coffee?
Ugh, we both wish, mister. No, we've got Bojar's blend. It's a sub. Not too bad if you mix it thick.
Fine, we'll have that, too. Bring the pot.
How about dessert?
Depends. What is it?
We got the special of the house.
Any good?
Well, it's been the special as long as I can remember.
I still don't know if that's good or bad. What is it?
Ever sink your teeth into the chewy goodness of a pecan nut log? They're a specialty of the house. Each bar individually wrapped in plastic for your sanitary protection.
Oh, good Lord, no.
I think we'll pass.
Ryan exchanged curious looks with a poker-faced JB, who had taken his rain-splattered glasses from his coat pocket and was using a piece of his shirt tail to clean them. Although seated next to Mildred, he paid her outburst no mind.
My doctor told me to lay off nuts.
Suit yourself. Seven stews and coffee it is.
Mind explaining what that little scene was all about?
I used to stop in places like this on vacations as a kid. Take the word of one who knows. If you've been in one tourist trap in Florida, you've been in them all.
What kind of trap?
Not a death trap, Jack. A tourist trap, it's a pre-dark slang term for a spot that suckered in the rubes. Take my word for it, you do not want a pecan nut log.
Speak for yourself, dear lady. Some of us here like pecans.
I should let you eat one, you old goat. But we don't have time enough to spare for you to drop your trousers with the squirts every 5 minutes when we get back on the road. Besides, they're probably left over from 100 years ago. All that business about individually wrapped. I'm guessing the damn things had a shelf life of over 1,000 years, and they taste like it, too. Worse than self-heat meals.
Really? I had no idea.
Take my word for it. Stay away from any candy in the shape of a log.
The waitress returned first with a tray of 7 steaming hot mugs of coffee sub that everyone agreed tasted like recycled wag coolant. But at least the fluid was thick and plentiful. The stew was a step up from the beverages. Chunks of real potato and bits of green parsley and cabbage were mixed in with some finely diced carrots and a kind of mystery meat that nobody could discern exactly.
I've had worse.
Must be why he went for a second helping.
As did you, young codder.
Dean's a growing boy, Doc. He needs his nourishment. You better watch out or you'll be dragging around a potbelly.
Oh, nonsense. The Tanner clan has always been blessed with a high metabolism. The more we eat, the leaner we get.
How about some bread for the broth?
Bread's extra.
No problem. We got the jack. And pack up an extra round to go. 2 pieces each.
4 men stepped in through the door, and oddly enough, they stepped in by order of height.
Damn! Something done smells like it up and died in here. By God, it better taste better than what my nose is telling me.
On the edge of his peripheral vision, Ryan saw Christie's red tresses begin to gently coil and uncoil of their own will. Not a good sign. Especially since his own radar had also kicked in triple overtime from the moment the 4 men swaggered into the restaurant. The quartet was dressed in a mix of tech and Western. The short, older man in front seemed to have the carriage of leadership. He also had a receding hairline, making his furrowed brow disappear into the brim of his crisp cowboy hat. Silver-gray mutton chops and white wisps of hair at the back of his ear stuck out from under the hat. In appearance, he was what Doc would term as a dandy. Only a few drops of rain had fallen on the small man's suit, since a second man, who was much taller, held a faded black umbrella above his head. The small man looked like a well-preserved 60-year-old and wore a dark blue pair of trousers, a cream brocade vest with matching puff cravat, and white spats. The spats were pulled over a pair of ancient brown lace-up shoes. A single stray speck of red mud dotted one of his feet, but otherwise, the outfit was immaculate. The only nod to the modern world in his accoutrements was in his choice of holster. It was hand-tooled leather, with a wide silver-plated buckle that matched the color of his hair. What looked to JB's trained eye like a 6-shot old-style Smith & Wesson rimfire revolver was holstered on his left leg. It was a near antique, but still deadly in the right hands. The little man also carried a slim walking stick with a silver handle. Ryan caught himself wondering if the man's cane contained a hidden blade like Doc's.
That guy sort of looks like a sawed-off version of Doc, doesn't he? Walking stick, funny old clothes, nose high in the air, like he was better than us.
Shh! Afternoon, I'm Benjamin Green, This strapping young lad behind me is my son Jackson. We're traveling with a second party for protection. This is Mr. Briggs and Mr. Constantinople.
The little man was speaking to the waitress, Sandy. The man identified as Green's son Jackson had been carrying the umbrella. He now pulled the collapsible shade closed and shook off the excess rainwater. Ryan could see the family resemblance behind the unfortunate waxed mustache that Jackson had chosen to wear. The facial hair was coal black, like the man's hair. The black was too much and looked artificial. Ryan suspected the liberal use of a bottle of hair dye. Perhaps the son was prematurely gray, and that was his way of rebelling against the unstoppable onslaught of age and or resembling his father. Vanity was usually the first thing to go when traversing Deathlands, but the father and son team looked to have an ample supply. In addition to vanity being a deterrent when attempting to move quickly, a vain man was almost always a man with too much jack in his pockets. Ryan suspected the Greens' traveling companions weren't friends. The one they referred to as Constantinople had the look of a sec man written all over him. Hired help. Like his father, Jackson was dressed in the splendor of the Old West, with selected nods to modern-day touches, a dark blue high-cut jacket with leather lapels, a white shirt starting to droop from the dampness, a loosely tied lariat necktie held closed by a silver bolo. His trousers were tight and appeared to be made of a mix of shiny black leather, dark gray nylon, and canvas. The toes of his once gleaming black cowboy boots were also tipped with silver. Sterling tips very similar to the ones Christie favored and currently wore. For protection, Jackson carried a stripped-down remade Uzi, a simple fire hose with a pistol grip capable of emitting a steady stream of bullets. The weapon hung from a shoulder strap down at his left side for easy access, right below the bottom of the short coat he wore.
Nice suits!
Why, thank you! Will you seat us?
Pick a table. Don't matter which. Get yourself situated and I'll take your orders.
Are you on the menu?
No, I'm not. And if I was, you couldn't afford me.
As the blonde disappeared in the back, Constantinople watched the shallow movement of her hips.
Not much of a ride back there, but I guess it'd do in a pinch.
You'd crush her, big man. Smash her right into the ground once you got pumping.
Damn straight.
Constantinople glanced at the older man.
Well, Ben, you planning on eating before dark, or are we going to go out and catch our own? Well, I guess we could continue to stand here with our thumbs up our asses waiting for the lady to bring us grub, if you won't.
Green nodded and gestured for the others to choose a table. As the group strode past Ryan's table, the one-eyed man noticed that Constantinople was the classic example of a big man gone to seed. The broad shoulders and imposing height and weight had probably once made him an unstoppable opponent in hand-to-hand combat, but an appetite as huge as his frame had added weight to his flabby cheeks, his thick neck, and his colossal stomach. A patch of hairy pelt could be seen at the apex of his middle, where a shirt button had buckled and fallen under the constant assault of his gut. Constantinople was no intellectual. That could be seen in his wide face and half-lidded, cruel eyes. Unlike the Greens, he was no fashion lover. He wore a dirty brown duster, red-checked flannel shirt, jeans, and boots that were more mud than leather. Perched on his skull was the quintessential 10-gallon hat, a tall hat with a wide brim, much like its owner. A semi-automatic handgun was tied down to his right leg. The last man, the one called Briggs, took the initiative and sat down first, picking a table across from Ryan's group in the opposite corner of the dining room. As if to express his own lack of interest in his fellow diners, he sat with his back to them. Briggs was all in shades of brown. Brown kerchief, brown gloves, brown hat, brown coat. Even his hair and his bushy eyebrows were brown. The waitress returned when the men were seated. She held her pad and looked at the new customers impatiently.
What's good tonight?
Stew.
Stew?
Got grits on the side if you want them. All out of bread. Won't be no more up for another hour or so.
We'll have stew then. And grits. And 4 cups of coffee.
4 stews and subs coming right up.
Sandy quickly returned with 4 chipped mugs and a lime green metal pot. After filling all 4 mugs, Sandy had nearly made it away from their table before silently having to endure a quick slap on the rump from Jackson. Ryan couldn't help but notice that Jackson seemed more interested in impressing Constantinople than actually getting any sort of thrill from smacking the waitress's butt.
Refills?
Of course, my dear. 'Tis poor to the palate, but it does give one fire in the belly.
Fire in the belly? Hell, that's gas. You could run an engine off this stuff.
Cut the chatter and drink up. I've got a bad feeling about the boys who just joined us. I'd rather avoid any trouble if we can help it. My stomach's full, and the last thing I want is to exert any energy dealing with a bunch of stoops.
Sandy returned with a serving tray bearing four wooden bowls of stew and a stained brown paper bag. After setting down the bowls of food, she tucked the tray under one arm and stepped over to Ryan with the bag.
Bread's inside. I've got your check up at the register. We can settle up whenever you're ready.
Let's do it.
Why'd them goddamn stoops get bread and we didn't?
What did you say?
Nothing to you. Talking to the waitress.
I don't care who you're talking to. I want to know why it was you felt a comment was necessary.
If you must know, Four Eyes.
Four Eyes. Now that's a classic insult that never goes out of style.
I was wondering why there was bread for you and none for us.
They were here first. Ordered it before you came in. Sorry about that. Today's been busier than usual. Plenty of stew left. Should fill your belly.
The little man looked at his son.
There you go. Problem solved. Sit down, Jackson.
The son obeyed, staring hard at Ryan and JB.
Which way you all coming?
West.
Ryan shifted the paper bag with the bread into his left hand and smoothly dropped his right beneath the table and to his holster.
Smart to travel in a group. I tried to do the same.
I noticed that. Right about the same time you made a point of telling everybody in here.
Hey, I gotta know something. See, I'm not used to seeing men traveling with two such fine pieces of ass. Three, if you count the boy. And I was wanting to know where I could buy myself some traveling leg, coos on the loose, a walking, talking velvet snaptrap. You know what I mean?
Brother, there isn't enough money in all of Deathlands. You keep looking, though, hon. You might find yourself a real relationship instead of the one you've got going on right now with your hand.
Who's the banshee?
The big man was pointing at Jack. Ryan could see the albino's muscles tense across the table, but the youth kept quiet.
I'd say he was one of those friggin' vampires I heard about down along Louisiana way. But last I looked, it was still daylight outside. He's some kind of fucking mutie or what?
Oh, what?
Jack slid a pair of small leaf-shaped throwing knives from the secure hiding place along the underside of his left forearm.
Chew your fat ass quick.
Ryan gave the teenager a warning look. The ruby-eyed albino gave a barely perceptible nod and again fell silent. So did the obese man, who chose to have another large swallow of his coffee brew.
That's a lot of double big talk from a scrawny pecker like you, Weddy. I think you're some kind of spook. Yeah. Some kind of ghost who walks and talks, but ain't real friendly, eh? Freaking horror show.
Now ease up, boy. Let these folks be.
You better listen to your daddy. We're not looking for trouble. There's no muties here, just hungry folks like yourselves. We just want to pay our tab and get back on the road.
Well, what's your big hurry?
Trying to get away from pricks like you. To be honest with you, pretty boy, I don't need the aggravation.
Ryan
had the ability to read a situation, although his own gifts weren't the result of mutation, as was the case with Christy. In his years of roaming Deathlands, encountering the good and the bad in people from all walks of life, Ryan had become a keen observer of human nature. Not universal nature, although he understood quite a bit about what drove a person to act in a manner to injure his fellow, but more of a face-to-face understanding of what a man would do under the right circumstances. The green boy was trouble. Handlebar mustache, fancy duds, dyed hair and all. Some burst of testosterone had flooded his brain. Now the conversation had dropped all pretense of being civilized, and had gone the way of a pissing contest.
Maybe I'll just chill your one-eyed ass and take what I want you!
Jackson raised his Uzi. In response, Jack's right arm snapped down like a released cobra. The blade spun at an angle, singing across the standing man's throat in a near-invisible blur of movement, ultimately embedding itself in one of the orange seat cushions of an empty booth across the dining area.
One way to shut him up.
JB whipped out a scatter gun to back up Jack's play. Then Constantinople was moving.
Drop it! Drop it or you both chilled!
My boy! My boy! You've chilled Jackson! Oh, no!
Fire blast. That tears it.
Briggs whirled to green, as if he were trying to catch the older man. Instead, all he caught was some of the lead from the old man's Uzi.
Damn! He killed his own man!
Not on purpose, Dean.
Yeah. Accidents tend to happen when you're blasting like this in close quarters. And apparently the father wasn't much smarter than the son.
Once, just once, I'd like to finish a meal in peace.
They started it.
Don't they always start it, Jack?
Yeah, they always do.
Ryan caught Christie's eye and held her gaze in his own until she turned away.
And we always finish it, one way or another.
Well, I don't have to like it.
Christie retreated out of the eatery and through the front door, walking out alone in the rain.
Like a tomb in here.
Don't sweat it, Jack. We're still alive, tomb or not.
Sandy slunk out of hiding from an alcove between an old cash register and the swing doors under the coffee machine.
Would you look at all this? All in less than a minute.
I know those kind of men aren't the sort of clientele you'd normally want to have in such a fine eating establishment as Tucky's. Am I right about that?
Yeah, but I'm the one who's stuck having to mop up after these stiffs.
JB and Mildred finished a joint examination of the four dead men. The armorer for any usable ammunition or Jack, Mildred to see if any were still alive. However, she already knew before attempting to find a pulse that she was wasting her time. So was the armorer. The guns were passable, but had little or no ammo. Worthless when compared to the weight they would entail for a weary traveler looking for a place to sell them. He found a little Jack and some tiny precious stones and bits of metal, which he stuck in an inner pocket of his leather jacket. The cook finally made his way from the kitchen, carrying a pump-action scattergun. A pear-shaped black man, he was working bare-chested under a dirty apron and work trousers.
Need any help?
No thanks, Chef.
Ryan paid the bill. He took an extra octagonal-shaped golden coin from the secure pouch beneath his shirt and dropped it on the counter near the old cash register.
We can handle it from here. Why don't you put away the firepower and get back to your stove? You look like a man more comfortable with a spoon in his hand than a blaster.
Well, I was busy.
Of course. A chef is always obsessed when at work in the kitchen, crafting his culinary delights.
Ryan looked to the waitress.
Sorry about the mess. Once he's got his pots and pans under control, get the big guy to help you dump the stiffs behind back. And maybe you can have things cleaned up in time for the supper rush. And you might want to think about anteing up for a halfway decent sec man to watch the door of this place. Pay him in food. There's men who'd be glad to do whatever you told them to for less.
Outside, Christie had taken temporary shelter beneath the overhang of the arched roof. A torrent of water poured down the rusted broken drain pipe near her legs as she leaned against the boarded upside wall of the eatery. Ryan and the others came out of the building and walked past the flame-haired beauty without any comment. Ryan hung back, letting Jack take the point, as the group began the march back up to the main highway.
Let's go.
I just get tired, Ryan. Tired of killing.
I know. We all do. Each of us just have different ways of dealing with it.
Christie reached out and took her man's hand, gripping it tightly and intertwining her fingers with his.
I love you, Ryan. Nothing will ever change that.
He didn't reply, but held her hand even tighter, as if he would never let go. They would have to pry away his cold, dead fingers first. Many days had passed without incident, other than a battle of wits between a hungry Jack and a hungrier JB for the last piece of bread from Tucky's. Mildred had averted any overt displays of bad temper between the pair by declaring that she was going to eat the final helping, and she did so with a smile that openly dared either of the men to say otherwise. There had been some small game along the way, and thanks to the endless rainfall, plenty of water to drink. Dean took a bad tumble when a piece of the crumbling old asphalt gave way and he slid down a muddy embankment on his butt, whooping all the way. Luckily, the only real injury seemed to have been to his pride and to his clothing. Soon after the mud began to dry, his jeans were extra stiff and able to stand up by themselves. The rain had finally let up a few days earlier. Ryan reckoned they had walked right through a near-permanent monsoon season over the upper stretch of Florida. Now they had reached a destination of sorts. The marina might at one time have been attractive. All it offered the exhausted group of companions was a crowded maze of black-rotting timbers, both underfoot and overhead. Most of the structure looked to be in poor condition, but down at the edge of the water, two empty slips gave all of the indications of recent activity. The wood of the individual piers of both these slots had been replaced or repaired with fresh lumber. More than half of the marina was protected from prying eyes by a high wooden wall. A faded red and blue sign proclaimed the site as being Schwartz's marina. Ryan could tell from the condition of the sign that Schwartz was either long dead or completely lacking any pride in the place. Most of the boathouses that could be seen from outside were open, while the rest contained partly or fully submerged wrecks in the brackish water. The group had arrived at dusk. In the fading light of the sun, the ruin of a marina looked even more forlorn and spectral. Still, as far as Ryan could see from where he was standing behind the mesh wire restraining fence, there were no guards or would-be protectors in place.
What do you think?
Place could use a coat of paint. Something festive in orange.
Gaia, don't remind me of that place.
You volunteering to pick up a paintbrush?
Not on your life, John. I didn't go to medical school to become a painter.
No eye tied to walking. Boot heels wore off.
Mine too.
As are my own. A sea voyage is sounding better and better to my weary bones.
Then it's settled.
All quickly agreed that what little novelty walking across Florida on the old interstate had initially offered had long worn off. Even Ryan had suffered some deep pains in his ankles from the constant days spent treading on the paved highway.
Joint looks deserted. Probably won't find anything that floats. My guess is if the boats were worth a damn, they were scavenged long ago.
Tell me something I don't know, J.B.
I thought that fellow back on the highway said we could purchase transport, or better yet, a vessel at this docking port.
He could have been lying, or wrong, Doc. Or maybe the sellers have gone home for the day or been put out of business. Either way, let's rack and see what's what before all the light is gone. Split up. Dean, you and me and Christy will check the boathouses.
Ryan gestured to J.B.
J.B., take Mildred, Doc, and Jack and go over to the private ports. Look for any supplies we can use, or a boat that's still halfway afloat. We'll meet back here at the gate of the sec fence in 20 minutes.
J.B. glanced at his wrist chron and mentally noted the time.
20, right. Got it. But don't start the clock till I've opened the door.
The lump of a lock and the rusted links of chain wrapped around the main gate of the marina entrance were easily navigated by J.B., who had taken a flat black case from a pocket and removed a tiny collection of antique locksmith's tools.
You'd have made a heck of a thief, John.
Why, thank you, Millie.
Good friends. Perhaps our luck is changing.
10 minutes into their search, a well-maintained cabin cruiser had been discovered.
Something this nice has got to belong to somebody. Jack, take the rear point. See if anybody wants to say hello.
They might be scared, John. I know I'd be concerned if someone came sniffing around my boat. That gate was locked for a reason.
I'm not planning on stealing the thing, Millie. Just curious. I want to know where the owner is.
Think I found our boat.
The rest of the friends went around to see what had ignited Jack's interest.
This has to be Ryan's ride, no question.
Emblazoned on the rear of the boat in tall blue cursive letters was the craft's name. Jack was pointing and grinning.
The Patch. Dame Fortune seems to have smiled on us at last.
Yeah, she's good at that. Right before she kicks you in the teeth. Nobody flick an eyelash and you might get out of this alive.